Greetings. Greetings, one and all. This is 372 pages we'll never get back. I am Michael J. Nelson. Tell him who you are.
I'm Connor Lestoka. Mike.
Oh, hi, Connor.
Yeah, good to see you. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, nice to talk to you.
Wish it was under better circumstances, but
yeah,
you know.
I was going to say, yes, indeed. It seems like every time we talk, there's something bad that we have to talk about.
It is. It's like we just only run into each other at funerals.
Yes. But no, we're making our way through. This is the podcast where we talk about bad books. So that's probably the reason why, now that I think of it. And we're making our way through a very, very, very terrible, bad, horrible, awful book called Ready Player Two.
It is the Alexander's Day of Books. It is the no good, very bad, horrible, best-selling book.
But there's been a few developments. Well, a notable development. Why don't we just launch into that before getting into the meat of this thing? And we have the departments again, right?
Of course.
We're going to do real or fanfic. We have mail from listeners.
We have dumb sentences.
Dumb sentences galore.
I believe there's something from the dark web that we dug out. So we'll have to.
Oh.
Yeah. Explore that.
Great.
I'll hit you with that as a surprise at some point in time.
Great. Well, I'll start and then you can, because I don't have the, there's an email involved here.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a meeting with our regular Riff Tracks meeting. For those who don't know, Riff Tracks is kind of what we do on the other side here. It's our main living.
Mm-hmm.
And our CEO is a friend and a beloved man, very well read, smart. During the meeting, it came out that he's a big fan of Ready Player One.
It is like,
take across the keyboard.
And, right. It's like when you're having a Thanksgiving dinner and someone, like an uncle, lets something slip that you're like, wait a second, does he really believe we faked the moon landing? Like, does he,
right.
Elders of what now? Like,
yes. there's a meeting with a bunch of other people. So there's not much, we didn't spend much time on it, but I confirmed and he said, yeah, I was into those video games. I liked it. I'm reading Ready Player Two and I'm enjoying that, he said. And I just said that's technically impossible. Like,
right.
Dude, it can't be true. So anyway, why don't you finish the story then?
Well, it was just, I think it was either Saturday or Sunday night of this weekend. It was the evening, well past the time when you would typically email coworkers or friends just because it's, relaxing time, whatever. So obviously something was weighing heavily on his mind. And me and you just get an email with the subject line, page 280. And it just said, no introduction, no pleasantries, no how's your weekend. Ready Player Two officially becomes unreadable. This book is so bad. I like the first one, I admit, but this one, oof. And so I said, absolutely, I mean, good, I'm glad he's seen the light. It's like a cult member having the being deprogrammed or something. But then I flipped to, I was like, is this the Halcedonia chapter? Is this the part where he talks about his mother's death? Like, what pushed him over the edge? We have not gotten to Ready to page 280 yet. That is going to come in our next section. So at some point in time...
And you didn't cheat. You didn't look ahead.
No, he wasn't looking ahead to find like real for fanfic or real. He got here and then something happens probably in the prince battle that has broken his spirit.
No, I mean, you didn't look ahead to see what the event, what the probable event
no,
was
no, no,
that
no,
caused
no,
him
no,
to...
No, no, no.
Finally toss the book across the
no,
room.
But I'm guessing, it's something involving the Prince Planet or something like that. And I for one cannot wait to find out what this is. What is the straw, what is the here and no further moment.
But until that moment, let's say the fifth chapter of John Hughes' universe,
mm-hmm.
He's sitting there with robe slippers and meerschaum pipe going, yes, indeed. This is good stuff.
He's doing the John Candy chuckle. He's, he's calling his family over to peer over his shoulder like a dad reading The Night Before Christmas to them type of thing. Look, honey, yeah. Halcedonia. He's referencing Zubily Zoo.
I guess so.
It's like
anyway,
a Norman
said
Rockwell
he
painting,
would,
yeah.
Yeah, he said he would come on the show and defend his...
Wow, all right. Oh, I did not know that. That's, yeah, there we go.
So he sort of sighed heavily before agreeing to do it. So.
That's going to be like a Jerry Springer segment of just like berating and, you know, Steve Wilkos holding me back.
Exactly. Connor, please, he's the CEO. Oh, anyway, all right, well... Shall we dive in?
I think so. I think we've done that enough. Before we do, though, you did ask me to run some numbers.
Run the numbers on that, can you?
Yeah. I think you just, you know, you. I could tell your tone was just, you know, sputtering rage. It was just like, how many times do these idiots roll their eyes? I don't know what provoked that in the book, but, you know, when it was the sort of thing, I think, like Bella blushing, that I looked back on it and I was like, happens a lot. So in the book, there is 154 mentions of eyes, which, you know, unless it's a biography of Dr. T.J. Eckelberg, that seems awfully high. and then so it was hard to say because you could phrase he rolled his eyes. She rolled, you know, you could do that a couple different ways. I counted 13 eye rolls.
Okay, that seems low, but
it does.
Yeah,
but
all right.
Some of them were on the same page of the book, so he is liberal with them. And then you have in this section, certainly a lot of eyes widening.
Okay, their
eyes widen to be, you know, they end up looking like, you know, giant squids. I think of the world's largest eyes, or you know, the Tex Avery wolf. But then a very high amount of something I had not noticed yet. And I think it comes in, so there are 15 widening eyes. Coming in right under that with 14 are locking eyes.
Oh.
We locked eyes, or our eyes locked is a go-to.
Huh. Do they lock their eyes before they do one of their little like dances and golf clap presentations?
Which... Yeah, if you get a funky dance while locking eyes, and then someone applauds the funky dance, I think that's the Kleinfecta.
Right. Oh, it's well, just another indication. I'm sure there are other things in the book and cliches that he used that maybe outpace the eye rolling, but this one just caught my eye, as they say.
It does. And it is the sort of thing that, you know, if in a movie, let's say, if you kept cutting to someone in a hour and 45 minute long movie and there were that many eye rolls, could you even imagine? Like, that would be absurd.
If
they were just pulling, you know, a sitcom child, like at their dumb dad type of thing, like.
Right. Oh, well, let's start in on the eye rolls here.
Yeah.
And tally them up.
It's like you said, chapter 17 begins, we're still on the John Hughes planet. We are completing the quest for the third part of the shard, or the third shard, I guess.
Is this the third? Wait, which ones did Og get? Did he only get one?
I believe Og has got the first three shards before he was, you know, captured, tied to a chair, beaten with a knotted rope. That's how I remember it.
That's precisely it. Was he doing it with the bottom was cut out of the chair?
Oh yeah, Og is his sack has been well worked over. It's been speed bagged. It's been. Yeah. Le Chiffre nods in approval.
All right. So what we're in the middle of in this quest is because the shard had a riddle about fowl, F-O-W-L. Mm-hmm. No, it was the other way around.
It was the other way around. But
the other way.
It turned out it was... it was.
And it turns out the solution, of course, is that it's just a homonym to fowl and that they were talking about Ducky from John Hughes. And they hit upon that and they all went, yeah, you're a genius. You figured it out.
Right.
So they're recreating the original ending of Pretty in Pink.
Yes.
To get a shard.
The Hughes cut, if you will.
Yes. And so right now they're trying to persuade an NPC version of Robert Downey Jr.
Yes.
To go to a dance.
Correct. So he can meet NPC Andy McDowell. I mean, not Andy McDowell, the other one. And then they can be reunited, and that will then grant them the shard. But in order to do that, I'm lost in my notes because so much of it was dumb that I didn't take notes of it. But they it starts with them speeding through to reunite them, and I thought this was just an interesting way to start the chapter. Artemis knew a shortcut through the rich side of town and was somehow able to navigate from memory, racing through the dark, undifferentiated maze of identical streets. And so I don't know if this was like an existential thing about memory. Like, mm-hmm. you know, he says she's somehow able to do that. Like, I'm somehow able to, like, you know, pick up my phone and dial Lauren's phone number. I know it. And we know that Artemis has been on this planet many times, hanging out and doing all this garbage. So, you know, is she also somehow able to, like, ambulate by instructing her central nervous system to place one foot in front of the other?
I guess if you knowing something and being able to be aware of your knowledge of something are two separate things.
Sure,
maybe he's not aware that those are, I think that's a primary thing in philosophy, is that we have knowledge of our own thoughts is one of the only certain things we have. But he's thrown some real doubt on that right here.
I guess so.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my first note was that, I didn't have a lot of notes for this chapter because it's just them. Well, we'll see. But Artemis gave me a dubious look and folded her arms. And I just thought, the missed opportunity. Did she momentarily look like Storm or maybe Sailor Moon or something?
Yes.
Well, why waste an opportunity to throw something really stupid in there?
Yeah. Who's a notable arm folder? That has to be one of the poses that a third tier Mortal Kombat character strikes when they win a match or something.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Anyway, he's getting lazy, is what I'm saying.
Well, did they lock eyes there? Did you say or just
gave me a dubious look. So did the eyes start to roll? I don't know.
It's hard to say. That sounds like, yeah, it's neither here nor there with the notable eye things. But then we get a needle drop of Mogdigliani, Lost in Your Eyes by Book of Love. Mm. And hearing it, Artemis glanced over at me and we shared a brief smile of recognition. And so I think this is like, to me, that was sort of like the book describing itself. Like, that's what we're meant to be doing here. We're meant to just be reading things and engaging in brief smiles of recognition as we do it.
Yes.
Like you always say, the laughter where you just sort of blow up the briefest puff of air out of your nose. That is our takeaways here.
Yes. Or the, who did I see? I saw some folk singer, and the people in front of us, when they had finished the song, would go, mm. And sort of bite the bottom lip and go, shake the head and go, yes, that is a lot of truth happening there.
Well, hold on to that bite the bottom lip, because we got some of those coming up.
Oh, yeah. Does lip biting outpace the eye rolling? We'll have to run the numbers on that.
Definitely.
I didn't really understand what was happening in this, but they have to go and talk to Mrs. Johnson, mm-hmm. who I don't know who that is.
Mm-mm.
Maybe it's described in here, but then they say something to her, and Mrs. Johnson turns into Mrs. Hughes, John Hughes' actual wife.
Right. Yes.
John
Hughes John Hughes' wife and his kid are now NPCs that are all just sort of running around their house, and they're sort of taking this in like it's a magical, heartwarming moment.
Yeah. So they're loving this. This was why I don't have a lot of notes. I don't understand what's happening. How do they know that people are going to turn into other people, or what is the purpose of that?
I don't know. It's sort of just dream logic. When you're describing your dream to someone, you're like, it was my house, but it wasn't my house. And then it was my mom, but then it turned into John Hughes's wife. That sort of thing. It's like, yeah, I guess I know what you mean.
It was somehow half you and, you know, those kinds of things. Yeah.
Right. But John Hughes' wife invites them in, and we came to our first first Sonic challenge, I believe, that we've had in a while.
Oh, great.
Okay. I'm going to give it to you. Artemis, John Hughes bellowed in an extremely deep voice, smiling wide in recognition as soon as he saw her. I've been expecting you.
Oh, boy. This is almost a Who is the Sheriff?
That's what I thought, yeah.
Yeah. Bellowed?
Bellowed in an incredibly deep voice.
Artemis, what's the end of it? I'm trying
Artemis,
to
I've been
you.
Expecting you.
There it is. I see it. Okay. All right. I got to back off the mic, of course.
Please.
And hope that neighbors are far enough away.
Right. This hopefully is not going to hit like the brown noise tone or anything like that. It's going to be that deep.
Artemis, I've been expecting you.
There we go. That was sort
of
like
hard to bellow in my. I can get lower, but I can't bellow in the lowest voice.
Yeah, it sort of just oozes out. That was good. That was like a Muppet giant, like maybe the, okay. You know, the ghost of Christmas. Christmas is to come that comes and or Christmas is past that shows a Scrooge around.
Yeah. So I don't get what they. I'm not understanding how they have this attachment to NPCs.
It's revolting.
Because she's like hugging him and laughing him and they're slapping each other on the back and just having a great time with an NPC.
Artemis laughed and hugged John Hughes while giving me a can you believe this is happening look over his shoulder. So Artemis has, you know, has the Princess Diana / Mother Teresa / Joan Jett has, you know, undoubtedly meant, you know, royalty all over the globe. You know, presided, you know, worn black at state funerals for important people. And yet, yeah, she's just delighted by someone who they both understand not to be the actual John Hughes, to be a computer simulation of his mind. And she's just sort of, fangirling out, as they say.
She is super excited to, yes, meet a computer simulation of the guy who wrote Curly Sue. So trying to put that in perspective.
But yeah, he's impressed that the John Hughes NPC has a firm grip when he shakes his hands. Mm-hmm. Which again is like, you know, it's not a good thing to think about when you're just, you know, in a place where any given person you meet in the Oasis could be a 49-year-old pervert in his basement. You just don't want to be thinking about their grips, I would say.
Right. So he does what they ask him to do, which is to find the original draft of the Pretty in Pink script, which he does, and he's delighted to do it. I don't know. I didn't understand. I guess, you know, it's just how he's programmed. So
yeah, he's an NPC. He doesn't have a lot more going on. So
yeah. And when he does, he shouts, victory, I guess.
Victory!
And then a golden victory. Shaft of light descended from the ceiling for a few seconds, bathing him and the script in its glow as we heard the sound of angelic chimes.
My God.
I don't know what to say about that. I just I wanted to present you with that moment.
It's, you know, yeah, it's just, it's something out of a, you know, it's biblical, I guess, is what we're supposed to be taking away here from, you know, again, the author of 16 Candles.
Yeah. So plot wise, what else do I have? Oh, I just,
well, they take a look skips... at, they take, yeah, go take ahead. A look at his script and, you know, he sees Pretty in Pink and that gets our, I think, first big goofy grin. That Artemis has when she examines that, but then they take a look at his at John Hughes's like computer keyboard, and he says, Wade says, "Weird," I said, grabbing the keyboard to examine it more closely. That was when we both saw the brand name and the model number. So this is good. He's only noticing details when he stops to examine things. He's not looking at details, you know, before, you know, that, you know, it doesn't happen in reverse order. So order is somewhat restored to the universe here.
Good. Thank God.
But then you get a Dan Brown Digital Fortress style puzzle because they notice that four keys of the keyboard are missing. K-I-R-A. And Artemis says, holy shit, Kira. So you have that Susan Fletcher once again level of genius from our two heroes here.
And immediately after that, when she says, Kira, I nodded. Then another light bulb went on over my head. I didn't understand. Is that supposed to be literal? Is that a thing that happens in the game?
I don't know. You just had John Hughes being bathed in angelic light like an angel reading from on high. So it could be.
So it turns out that this is the keyboard that was in Weird Science?
Mm-hmm.
A memo text MTX 512, and he says, I should have realized that when we were back on Kodama or something. Like, he sort of, you know, hits himself on the head, like, dang, it's so obvious that this is the keyboard from Weird Science. Oh, like, my God, it's madness.
Right. Imagine, you know, your favorite thing in the world. So this guy, Ernest Cline's, are obviously terrible 80s movies. But I put together a trivia night like a couple weeks ago that a bunch of jackals showed up to participate in. And Lauren was like, I think you might be getting a little too in deep with some of these trivia questions. Like, these are things you like and know about, but not everyone's going to know. And I was like, pish posh. Everyone will know this answer. And then, you know, people, of course, did not. But if you did a trivia night and you're like, what was the model of the keyboard in Weird Science? People would just like overturn their table and storm out because they would just be so annoyed.
I guess, you know, the trivia, if you take it at its word, that is the most trivial thing a person could think of. So
sure.
it checks out.
But then I keep putting these in throughout this episode because it's important to keep this in mind when we're talking about all the stupid things that happen. This is where they check in, and I believe it's currently 5 hours until the mass death event happens. Before the 12 hours are up and everyone dies and they're strapped into their rigs. And so that puts this next part in perspective. He reaches out to Lohengrin saying he needs help, but this causes Artemis to give him a dubious look and fold her arms. A friend, she repeated. What friend? Was that a hint of jealousy in her voice? So she's getting all sort of sassy about this because she's worried that he might be, you know, cozying up to another person. And it's like, again, 5 hours before everyone dies. And it's just sort of, you'd imagine, you know, to call back Princess Diana, if she was going to be like engaging in one of the meetings about, you know, removing landmines or something.
Yeah.
But then Bill Clinton was like, oh, you know what? I will call in a favor from the UN Secretary General. And she's like, well, fine, I guess. Like, you know, and then she freezes
the
Secretary General.
Who is this friend of yours?
Yeah, it's like, yeah. We're working towards the same goal in service of mankind here. I don't think there's any room for this sort of thing.
So then plot-wise, they get Robert, who they call Robert Ducky Jr., is that supposed to just be a joke? I don't know.
Yep.
But he's also an NPC, mm-hmm. but for some reason, he's down with the idea of changing the ending to Pretty in Pink.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get flashbacks to, oh, he gets the shard because he gets Ducky to dance with Andy or something. I don't know.
Yeah, Andy, who was biting her lower lip when they saw her and looking around nervously.
And then he becomes Kira again. We know what that means. but here, it's all of this idiocy is topped off with a nice Kleinism at the end. So here we go. In that instant, I also felt her intense physical reaction to Og's glance and his smile. And it gave me a sense of just how profoundly Kira had loved him. Samantha's smile still gave me the exact same sensation. A sensation best described as devastation. So again, his commenting on his own.
Right.
That can only be described. A sensation best described as.
Well, take your word that however you're describing these things to us is the best way, since it's your world and your story.
Just as we go forward, just choose the best way, whatever you think is best. And we'll assume that it is.
Well, I think he did describe this next thing the best possible way. Also part of the same flashback, because I guess Kira, he mentioned this earlier, had an abusive stepfather, a short, bald man in a ragged shirt in the midst of yelling something in his thick Cockney accent. This had to be Kira's drunken stepfather, Graham, who was clearly enraged and only keeping his distance thanks to the cricket bat that Og was clutching with both hands and brandishing threateningly like Shaun of the Dead. So there's your scene of drunken abuse being intervened in by the weapon that even that just has not even a reference, just saying like Shaun of the Dead. And I guess Shaun of the Dead is just constantly brandishing a cricket bat. It's on the movie poster, but it seems like you could do that countless other ways that aren't just mid-aughts shorthand.
Yeah, I'm afraid I had that same note and I this is a slam on myself. My note next to it, I have nothing profound or funny or clever at all to say. I just had "eat me" written next to it. So. Yeah, it's another crossed her arms and looked like Wonder Woman, arms at sides and looked like Wonder Woman. It's just saying it because he thinks someone's going to get a thrill off the fact that they both know Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah, that's all it is. But yeah, would you know, like Shaun of the Dead, the movie, or like Simon Pegg in Shaun of the Dead, or is the character's name Shaun of the Dead? I don't know. Someone did email in and say that Simon Pegg of Shaun of the Dead was also the guy who played Og in the movie. So there's a another little revolting Easter egg for us, for our readers.
And so after he finished brandishing that thing like Shaun of the Dead, the abusive stepfather came over and whacked her upside the jaw, and she landed in the hospital for 6 days.
Right.
Like Pretty in Pink.
Right, yes, exactly. It's like, this sounds like an incredibly traumatic moment, man. Like, it's a good opportunity not to to lay on mid-tier level comedy.
Yes. But that's all I have for that very, very strange and wasteful chapter.
Yeah, our time on Shermer, Illinois has come to an end, fortunately. And the next step up is a trip to Halcedonia, which Wade describes as a huge stroke of luck because I'd spent a huge chunk of my childhood on Halcedonia, and my knowledge of it was encyclopedic even by Gunter's standards. So we get two huges there, which is good. And but then he says, I hadn't set foot on the planet in over 10 years, and after my last visit, I'd vowed never to return. So we're left on a slightly dramatic note.
I wondered, now this is entirely from the fertile imagination of our author, right? I don't think he's referencing anything here until he gets to the kids show. Well, right. Until he gets to this is where the Star Wars Holiday Special and Gary Ganu show came in, which was a fanfic favorite. So
I think he sort of went out on his own. I don't know whether this was an editor's note, whether this is an attempt at creating something that will then be merchandisable, but he's doing his own thing here, which a high wire act for someone who's more than anything proven that he has no good ideas of his own.
It's the Friendship Forest of Faraway.
My God.
And then if you complete like math puzzles or something, you get a bee-free treehouse.
Yeah.
Because when you're growing up in the stacks, the one thing you want is to put on your haptic suit and hang out in a treehouse.
In a treehouse with an endless assortment of furry friends and anthropomorphic animal teachers. Yes. So I think this is like the closest we're going to get to that side of the internet, to the even to inflatable rig cows. I think this is where that element hangs out in Halcedonia, teaching people.
Yes, and he would. Well, his mom was still around, so here's a reference to his mom. And I can only think of her hands at this point, but whatever. Sometime after she got off work, my mom would log back into the Oasis and join me there so I could tell her about my day or show her the artwork I'd made or introduce her to one of my new virtual animal friends. Can you imagine being tired from work and having to go through that bullshit?
Oh, my God. Yeah, just coming
this
home.
This idiot telling you about.
Yeah, coming
that's
home.
Great,
all
honey.
You want to do is back-to-back viewings of Say Anything, and your son is, making you look at the raccoon who taught him the ABCs.
It's one of my sons, when he was very young, would describe entire Arthur episodes to Bridget until she had to tell him, that's not interesting. You can't just do that.
No, you don't understand, Mom. He held his hand in a fist. The camera zoomed in on it. That's going to be huge in 15 years.
Right.
But yeah, so it's a my childhood moment, which this whole book is, but this is real sort of childhood, like, below 10 years old sort of stuff, which we really don't get a lot of. We get a lot of, preteen and teenage like fascination with Transformers and that sort of pop culture. But this is real like six and below type of educational thing. We get he talks about how he might see on Halcedonia any given moment Elmo from Sesame Street talking to Cherry from Pee-wee's Playhouse. And then they would both run over and invite me to play a game of Sorry. And so I looked it up. The idea of a mobile Cherry from Pee-wee's Playhouse, I don't think it actually ambulated around. And that is it's a terrifying thing to envision. Like Cherry just galloping across a landscape towards you. It's the sort of thing where then you would turn to run, but your legs wouldn't work type of thing.
Right.
You keep looking over your shoulder and it's gaining on you. Not a good mental image.
Point. Yeah. Your point is taken about the, you know, this whole book is an exercise in, you know, infantilizing everything, but he actually just becomes an infant in this one. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just references to TV shows. And it gets to this, which is very reminiscent of, you know, when I was a kid, there were always these 20 explosive hits from, it's been much parodied, you know, just like naming songs and playing a little clip from them and hyperactive.
Free to rock, turn it up.
Yeah. Well, this one, he says, you could just watch any show, which is a bizarre thing. Like you talked about millions of virtual tree houses lined up, literally millions of them. But amazingly, you can watch old TV shows. And then it just goes on to say, shows like 3-2-1 Contact, The Big Comfy Couch, Captain Kangaroo, The Electric Company, The Great Space Coaster, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, Pee-wee's Playhouse, Romper Room, Reading Rainbow, Sesame Street, Zoobly Zoo, and many, many more. Right. That's in his prose. Like, what are you doing? Yes, we understand.
Yeah.
You can watch TV shows.
And multiple readers wrote in to point out that list is in alphabetical order.
Yes.
But yeah, I don't know why he needs to leave it to us to envision TV shows. Because if you said picture a TV show, I'd be able to do that pretty easily. But I guess some of his readers need the assist.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I wonder which ones, if he was doing a Time Life ad, like which ones of those TV shows would get the treatment like the where they actually show the clips, you know, because what you were describing, Freedom Rock, they would say like, you know, Eric Clapton, Cocaine, and then it starts playing the riff but then it scrolls past, you know, five more before it goes to the next one. So you really got to highlight, I would say, Zoobly Zoo. I'm not sure if, I don't know if Great Space Coaster warrants that treatment. It's sort of like the Oscars where who gets the biggest applause in the In Memoriam.
Right. I'm sure. Yeah, that would be probably Pee-wee's Romper Room. That's pretty... Well, I guess that ran for many years. Do you have any memory of that?
No, just the name. I don't think I ever saw it.
That was I think that was just a syndicated one. You know, you just could, anybody could host in any town, could be a Romper Room.
Oh, man.
But that was very low rent. That was just, in my area, in the Chicago area when I was growing up, was just a kind of like a teacher, and it would just be like going to class, you know, like now we're going to learn this, or we're going to do a puzzle or something. I mean, it was very, very low rent. So
they'd ship you the whole set in a storage container and just, you know, a dusty Your Guide to Romper Room.
Yeah. Here, host a Romper Room.
Yeah. Try not to curse. We don't really care, but you know, right. Sometimes the kids will start crying if you really lay into them.
But then he says that he makes this mention because it immediately came to my mind of like licensing all of this IP is expensive. And he said, Kira and Og used their vast fortunes to purchase the rights to all these shows.
Mm-hmm.
And then he turned their characters into NPCs all over. I mean, those are complicated IP rights. You have to keep re-upping them. But I guess they just said, you know, we want the rights to all of your characters from Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood in perpetuity throughout the universe. Is that?
Yeah.
It's like, we'll give you limited digital rights for right. 5 years and then we'll re-up these. I just imagine Kira and Og just constantly on the phone going, look, man.
Yeah.
We need to license these for another 5 years. Like,
yeah, we lost the right to Roscoe, who played Gordon's likeness. We got to strip that out of there. His grandchild, who owns the family estate, is not going to be going to cause a big ruckus. Or it could have been like the Wonder Years or Dawson's Creek is on Netflix, but they couldn't get the rights to Paula Cole's I Don't Want to Wait, like Wonder for the theme song Wonder Years, and like Freaks and Geeks, it's really hard to license all the music. So like when they got Sesame Street, did they have to like dub in a weird fake version of like the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, yes. 10, 11, 12, or like the Alligator King song? They just had to do fake sounding versions of all that.
Exactly. They had huge staffs just working constantly to do this.
Yeah, maybe that was why the mankind descended into lawlessness and lack of goods and workers, because all the people were working on these deals.
Those must be the roving bands. They must be
they're all IP lawyers.
Yes. Anyway, yeah, I just like how he hand waves that away. But if you actually think about it, it's like virtually impossible that this would be a thing that you could do.
Especially if there's like, you know, more obscure shows. Like if they went, you know, if they tried to track down, Wizzo the Clown, there's just, you know, a great grandson or, you know, second removed who just is sitting there like being like, you want what? Oh, yeah, I guess my great grandfather was, a regional clown. Oh, man. Yeah, he left that somewhere in the will. I actually sold it to a guy to invest in a bowling alley.
But as we know, I was just talking about this the other day about the weirdest projects that we've ever done. We'll have someone that'll just be like, you know, not until you pry this out of my cold, dead hands. It means more to me than your filthy lucre. Right. Really? Wizzo?
Right. Yeah, they.
That's not true of that, but I'm just saying that's an example.
Right. Example. Yeah, exactly. If you you go and try to buy Sesame Street, and they're like, that'll just be $2 billion. You go and you try to buy VR Troopers or something that aired for a season and a half in a regional market, and that great great grandson's like, yeah, but you know what? I want to golf with you every Tuesday. That's my stipulation.
That's right. I'm making a new version of it, and I'm the star, and you're going to produce it. Yep. Anyway, all right. We can move on.
I want to just read some of the passages because they're so revolting to imagine this adult reading in a book for other adults. Wade says, "We're here," I said, pointing to the Friendship Forest. "The queen lives in Castle Calculus, which lies to the south, beyond the More Stuff mountain range and across the Seesaw Sea." And I just wrote, a book for adults. And it's obviously inspired, I would guess, by The Phantom Tollbooth, which was a book that I really liked growing up. And it has a lot of these, a lot of just for very basic puns and stuff like that. But it's sort of the thinking man's version of this.
Yeah. Yes. I'm calling out the editor again for this particular... "That was one of the many reasons Halcedonia had felt like such a magical place to spend my time as a lonely kid in the stacks. As I wandered across its magical landscape..." God, come on, man.
Well, it checks out, though. I mean, there you go. Why did it feel magical? Because it was magical. Science.
And then, as if we weren't infantilized enough, I opened a map of the planet and made it visible to everyone. It looked just like the map from Dora the Explorer, but I quickly muted it before it could start singing its own name.
Oh.
You are about to be plunged into a coma, sir. The entire world is going to be destroyed.
Right, yes. They do some singing later, so that's good. But not until he revisits his mother's death, which is the reason he had vowed never to come back here. Our hero does start sobbing. I don't know if we got that in the movie, but I believe he sobbed in the last book at some point in time. and, you know, obviously we don't like this character and we don't like the book, but you want to give him the benefit of the doubt. This is an emotional moment. We've all lost loved ones, so we can all empathize here. And yet he makes this very difficult. He says, "Samantha knew all about my mother and how I found her dead of a drug overdose on our couch when I was 11. That's rough. That's got to be hard. Anyone who knows someone who suffers for addiction or is in recovery, who has, God forbid, lost someone for addiction. It was heroin mixed with some other stuff, I think. You just, he can't help it, just shoot himself in the foot in this moment. He tries to solemn it up and just, you know, trips over a barrel into another barrel full of pickles. What on earth? Heroin mixed with some other stuff, I think.
I think. Yeah, I wonder if I should ask someone. Oh, well.
Yeah, right. Just, yes.
Just my mom's
some other
death.
Stuff. Was it mixed with, you know, the powder from a Lick-A-Maid? Was it mixed with Double down here, man. Was it, fentanyl, like, or just pixie sticks?
You're in charge here. You're writing this.
Right. You're also the richest man in the world. You can say, like, I want this dug up. I want this case reopened. I want to find the man who sold her this, and I want to cut off his fingers one by one.
Right.
Maximum revenge.
Speaking of undercutting, okay, we just had that moment. Now we get this. I led H, Shoto, and Artemis to the wheelbarrow and stood on a specific spot on the road beside it, then began to sing at the sky as loudly as I could. And maybe you know the song. It's the Great Space Coaster.
I do not. I don't know the tune. I don't know the show.
Get on board. Singing at the sky as loudly as he could. On the Great Space Coaster, we'll explore. My note next to that was, hey, how's your space arc going?
I forgot about the space arc. Isn't it like packed with embryos and stuff?
Yes.
Are the people on board that? I guess they have their own oasis or whatever, so maybe they're not tapped into this thing. But
yeah, anyway, just occurred to me while he was singing Great Space Coaster to the sky as loudly as he could.
Right. Artemis, who had, opposed that plan, who walked out of there, who voted not to ratify it, never spoke to him for 6 months after that, laughed and nodded with recognition again.
Oh,
and again, moments after he was sobbing at the memory of his mother's heroin overdose minutes ago. This is just to go back to the heroin. It is one of the dumbest things I think in the book, which is of course saying a lot, but he goes into some weird turf. He says that he had resisted the urge to explore what heroin felt like through the ONI's, flick mm-hmm. sinks or whatever.
Right.
But then he eventually gave in so he could sort of see what it was like. But he says doing a drug via ONI playback wasn't the same as shooting it into your own bloodstream. It felt the same, but it didn't cause the same long-term damage or physical addiction symptoms. And it removed the risk of accidental death. So it allowed me to experience the same high my mother had without destroying my brain and body in the process. Because if there's one thing that we've learned about the internet in the past 10 years, addiction, life destruction, ruining of things, it's not going to happen. It's just the computer. It's not real life. You can't get addicted to social media or pornography or anything else on there.
It's as safe as in your mother's arms, all of it.
It's incredible.
It's interesting that they took the time, I guess, during engineering development and testing to make sure that drugs worked with the ONI suit. Curious thing to do, but hey, that's thorough.
Right, yeah. The logging in for, the 13th time that day. I just want to feel how the heroin felt again. I'm not addicted because there's no physical thing. I just want to feel that sensation over and over again.
Right.
The Great Space Coaster was chanted at the edge of the Bee Free Forest, which contains an area named Holden's Field, a large, flat, open field of rye perched precariously on the edge of the Cliffs of Salinger. And just like his spaceship being named the Vonnegut, it's just so jarring when you, in the field where he's encountered Cherry the Chair and the Great Space Coaster, and then you encounter the Catcher in the Rye. It's so jarring to have things that are of actual, critical renown wedged into all this trash.
It's very jarring, especially since two sentences before he said, we don't have time to stop and play Blue's Clues, okay? So, yeah, it's very jarring to suddenly, like, please, we are being infants here. Remember that.
Yes.
We're not reading Salinger any right now.
And, like, you could, in theory, have a... He says that he had completed several different book report quests at several different grade levels here. So the teachers really need to get their curriculums in order in terms of being like, no. Like, Mrs. Jim Goshen in sixth grade, she made me do this. I don't need to do a seventh grade report, Mrs. Davis. Keep reading The Catcher in the Rye every year. But then there's no lessons taken away. Like just off the top of my head, I was like, okay, so he could learn, Holden's obsessed with phonies. He learns that, this simulation of real life is fake. He needs to go outside. There you go. Superficial lesson learned here, but nah.
No,
just a name drop.
Just a reference. Seconds later, he's talking about kids shrieking with glee as they're flying around in their spellicopters. So... So, once again, he can just go straight to hell. Uh-huh. I have two Sonic challenges
All right.
For you. The first one we kind of have to do together because behind me, I heard all three of my friends inhale sharply.
Okay.
So we'll just count down.
This is a Dale M. Courtney-esque simultaneous everyone doing it at the same time. Okay.
3, 2, 1.
Okay, you did more of a gasp, and I did more of a sucking in air through the teeth. All right.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, this one's going to be a little easier. This comes right after the second Sonic challenge. When I saw it, I began to chuckle in disbelief.
I guess I sort of just did that. Let me do an exaggerated version now.
Okay.
What does he see? Or do you know?
I forget what he saw.
The Great Space Coaster?
Must be a clue or a spellicopter. I don't know what he saw.
Would you believe that?
You kind of have to vocalize that to let everyone know.
We're just done disbelieving. I mean, otherwise, it's no different than the chuckle of hearing the "It's the '80s" song by Mondragon or whatever that was called.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Then we get some strange stuff. So we're flying around in spellicopters. We're seeing Great Space Coaster to the sky, and then Rain Man shows up.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Well, this is something that he looks at and he pretty much hangs a lampshade on, saying like, "I couldn't tell what it meant, but I clearly knew it meant something, and I would have to figure it out later."
Okay.
But yeah, Dustin Hoffman and Tom Cruise from Rain Man are there tapping something out in Morse code, and what they're tapping out in Morse code is Morse.
Yes.
Which in theory you could. That's the sort of thing that in a better book would be a puzzle you could actually solve. But it turns out it's just revealing information that's, about fictional characters in this book that you have, of course, have no way of knowing until it's revealed later.
And the pattern of their tapping reminded me of a scene in Star Trek V, The Final Frontier.
I did like that. That's a movie, that was the third movie I think we ever did a Riff Tracks for. So it holds a special place in my heart.
Wow. But what's the scene?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. The only part I remember that is...
He doesn't reference what it was. He just says, "for some reason." Anyway.
That rewards the true Gunters, though. You go and you look that garbage up, and that's when you really chuckle to yourself.
Right. All right. So I don't have many more notes for this.
He meets Queen It's-A-Lot, who in theory, what the quest is here is that you have to go earn all 50 Halcedonia merit badges, but he already did that as a kid.
That was a great undercut where they go, 50? We don't have time for that. There's so many of them. Like, yeah, don't. I did it. I earned them all already.
Right.
And tension over.
And then she reveals the shard to him in one of the... you can't... To say that you're in disbelief at how dumb something is at this point in time sounds like hyperbole and how we can't keep topping it. But just like the computer keyboard in the last thing where they didn't notice a detail on it until they took a closer look at it, this thing is along those same lines. He says, I guess he flashes back to another Kira flashback, but then says, "I found myself back in Queen It's-A-Lot's throne room on Halcedonia clutching the fourth shard. I didn't even have to turn it over to see the clue engraved into it. Because it already happened to be facing me when I held the shard up to look at it."
Wow.
So I don't know if he thought we were having huge moments of like him holding these things up and slowly turning them around as the same noise plays when John Hughes is enveloped in angelic light, but he just wanted to make clear that wasn't happening this time.
Oh, that would make reading any book very difficult if... we assumed that things were turned the other way, and therefore people were unable. How is he reading that book? Which way is it being held? Fear not, reader. It was facing his eyes.
Right. Just describing every... Yeah, if you describe everything that is needs to be done or does not need to be done, it's going to make every book quite a bit longer. I did not need to turn my car on because it was already running. I did not need to to open the door because it was already open. That would just padding your word count. That's a tip for our writers out there.
I think that he, if I had to guess, I think it's like that thing we brought up before, the unnecessary quotes around things when people write signs or whatever. Oh, yeah. I think he just panics every now and then and like, do I have to mention that it was facing me so I could read it? Yeah, I better just do it. And then he kind of forgets about it. You know, you just like, should this have quotes around it? I'm just going to put some quotes around something. And there probably should be some in here.
But so that ends the quest for the fourth shard, which if you'll notice, we had spent a little less time talking about it than the John Hughes planet shard. I just went to do the word count. It was 4,045 words to get the fourth shard versus 13,548 to get the third one. So that's...
Wow.
I think it's less than a third, which makes sense because one was talking about someone else's beloved works of art and the other one was the stuff where he challenged himself to come up with his own world. And so I think that's that shows you what he values and considers himself capable of.
Yes. This is another instance where I don't know why he feels compelled to say this, but H says... I probably know more about Prince and his artistic output than any other human being in history. I know, I said, do you have any idea how many times you tried to make me watch Purple Rain with you? So I guess in some, I mean, the dumbness is right there, but in some way, is he thinking that's the sum knowledge of Prince is to watch Purple Rain many, many times?
That is the indicator that you know more about Prince than anyone and his artistic output than anyone in human history. You try to pressure someone to watch his most popular work, I guess.
But he said that earlier, for like, even for Gunters, I knew more about this planet than anyone else on Earth. Like, why does he have to keep doing that?
Right.
You don't have to have to, as you're doing clues about things, like nobody has all knowledge of everything. It's enough to just go, hey, isn't that the thing that, oh, that's right. You like Prince. I know more about him than any other human being alive.
Yeah. H says before that, she says, we're in luck, guys. And it's like, well, that is lucky. And the luck just keeps sort of stacking up in this book with people being, preternaturally good at whatever the task at hand requires.
Yes. And then my final thing about this is he, at the end of getting the shard, he spends time to wave at the NPC queen. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it seems like a small thing, but why are you... Why are you interacting with the NPCs? You are on the clock here.
Right.
You know, they stop to do a little smile and nod to the queen and everything. Like, just go.
Yeah. I'm imagining it being like, a video game would clearly, to save memory every time something has, completed their task or is off camera, they just sort of like slump over, sort of like a limp puppet. So I'm guessing once the queen has done her task of presenting him with the shard, he doesn't have to turn around. She probably just sort of freezes. So he's waving at a mannequin.
I don't think you need to use your manners or anything on NPCs if you're under the gun for time, especially. But
yeah, he does not know Prince because when H pressured him to watch Purple Rain, it made him feel a little sexually confused and uncomfortable. So we've got that to look forward to. And I like this this response from Shoto, who Shoto doesn't do a lot, but he does make his contributions incredibly stupid and valuable throughout the duration of this section we read. But Shoto says, so where do we need to go? I take it there's a Prince planet somewhere? And H scowls at him and says, yes, fool. But, this is, again, Shoto, who has grown up his entire life, the Oasis has existed, saying that. That would be like me just saying, like, Prince, I suppose there's a Prince fan site on the internet. Yes. Like there's a site for, probably like dogs who look like celebrity, like dogs who look like Lady Gaga. Like that site exists. You don't even have to, sure. I would bet you money that exists. Like, but H clarifies, he says, we don't call it the Prince planet. Its name is an unpronounceable symbol. And I just read that and I was like, that was always the default. That's if you Google unpronounceable symbol in quotes, it's all about Prince. And everyone just sort of agreed you were going to call, I guess what it's called, love symbol number two. The way you say that is Prince changed his name to an unpronounceable symbol. But how many, you can't pronounce symbols. Like every symbol is by nature unpronounceable, right? Like if you saw the sign that's printed on a blue handicapped parking placard, how would you pronounce that?
Yes.
Right?
Yes, or like it symbolizes
something. Yes. If don't walk holding up the hand, like pronounce that. It's yes. it's a don't walk symbol. Like it strikes me as a colossal failure of language that everyone agreed to do that with the Prince thing, and everyone sort of went along with it. It's annoying. Yeah.
It is. It was probably the first story ever written about him. That's what he said. You know, it's an sure. unpronounceable symbol. Okay. I should point out though about just going back to Shoto. You know, it's a stupid thing to say. Maybe he was on the phone with his wife who was in the emergency room because their son is unable to get enough oxygen uptake or something.
Okay.
And you know, he's just. He might have other things on his mind.
He's a little distracted. Yeah, let's assume that going forward, because the actions he takes in later chapters. His son is one of the first ones to suffer from the infirmware. There we go.
Yes, exactly.
And so Shoto's he's turned off his notifications. He's on silent mode, and his wife is trying to get him in touch so that he can be there as the last rites are administered.
Right. He's got the motion blocking software on, and he's basically just, he's an NPC almost himself, you know, just like he puts a little follow target on Samantha or something, and then he's basically not there. So,
yeah. Well, yeah, it ends with them saying that they have to go to the Afterworld, which is a planet of Prince that represents downtown Minneapolis in the 1980s. So I'm sure that's going to just be like coming home for you. It's going to be local references and things you adore, and just you can do your own chuckle and recognition at.
It was very, very odd, but we'll get to the specifics of that.
Okay. Well, there is another shard to get to, but first, a board meeting.
Yes.
Chapter 19 is a board meeting. They go to meet with Faisal, where he is. He informs our crew that Anorak has unfortunately initiated phase two of his plan, which is to alter all the NPCs to go rogue and then kill and loot the users.
Mm-hmm.
He says, Anorak has figured out a way to alter the behavior of our NPCs. And we all shouted, what, in unison? again, like Dale M. Courtney characters. And I assumed that Shoto, who is, as we know, using a translation software, shouted what like a half a second, after everybody.
Right. This is another example of him just having no idea how to roll out story, because this is considered worse than what's already happened. Like, it's downright apocalyptic. Like, isn't that, that's what's at stake already. It's already in play, right? That's what we're currently doing.
Mass death, so it like just a literal strikes, apocalypse.
Yeah, so it strikes me as very, very stupid to stop everything and say, oh, you know how we're all about to die in 2 hours? Well, here's something even worse. People's avatars are being destroyed by NPCs. And they all go, God, you're right. That is so much worse.
Well, yeah, I guess he might be saying, like, this is going to start to alarm people that we've already assured, remain calm. Kevin Bacon in the classic 1977 80s movie Animal House.
Right.
But I guess it's going to tip people off because things are turning into a nightmarish mashup of Westworld, Future World, and Jurassic World. So he can't even he's just using the previous scenarios that, yes, all of those books use, and even some of them were written by the same guy to drive home his point about what's happening here.
You forget how terrible that sentence actually is, because it ends with a smattering of Imagination Land, Tomorrowland, and Zombieland all mixed in for good measure.
Yeah.
So he ties that big bow up with a bunch of stupidness and then a dumb, dumb, dumbass cliche. He really is a moron.
Yeah, I don't know. You get the point. If you just said it's like Westworld, we all understand yes. that, and Jurassic Park. I mean, it's interesting he didn't go with the Jurassic Park, he went with the Chris Pratt movie.
Right.
But then, Tomorrowland is just that's where Space Mountain's located, right? Like nothing bad happens there. It's just, the future of yesterday at Disneyland.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that one, so yeah.
Tomorrowland is you know, there's Frontierland, there's
oh, it's just the future at Disney World.
Yeah, it's the name of that area.
Okay. Weird. But here's a little quiz for you. All these NPCs, we saw surfers, sidekicks, shopkeepers, pit mechanics, butlers, maids, background citizens, and wise old mentors all going postal on hundreds of different Oasis worlds.
Hell yeah.
What year is it in this book? Postal is still being used?
Yeah, I think it's 1998, baby. It's back. Going postal is back.
All right.
I mean, that's, you know, that's or the slang of, you know, like the much lamented 90s, late 90s swing dance boom where you could call someone daddy-o or something again. Every 50 years, those trends come back.
It's good to see it back.
But all those NPCs are lined up at Castle Anorak, where there's hundreds of thousands of NPCs lined up in front of it, their ranks already stretching to the horizon in every direction, like orcs amassing around Isengard. Which version?
I have that exact note. From which?
It's just, I'm pulling my hair out trying to decide. Bakshi, literary version, Peter Jackson Films. It's,
I know. And if I picture it wrong, then I don't know where we go from here on out. Like, this exactly. We're tripped up.
Yeah. Or is it like the, you know, what I presume, I think there was an identical scene in the Ready Player One movie where just all the characters amassed around that castle there too, so.
Oh, yeah. Can he mention his own movie at some point?
Oh, man.
Is that going to come up in this book?
That would be one of the most unfortunate things, I think, in a... I mean, you know, I can tick some off in my lifetime of bad things that have happened, but that would be up there on, that would be on one hand. I think that would rank if he did a little in joke. If Ernest Cline met an Ernest Cline NPC, I might have to go postal myself. God.
We get an indication, you know, we keep hearing about, again, roving bands and all of that, world on the brink of collapse. Sorrento appears to be accessing the simulation through a series of overseas proxy servers to mask his real-world location.
Nice.
So, plenty of functioning overseas proxy servers. Everything seems great. How exactly are we on the brink of everything falling apart?
I don't know. I mean, you'd think that would introduce some of the hated lag as well, having to connect through all those different things. But
totally.
Yeah, they mentioned that later where the house that Og picks for them to go to is one that they set up because it has one of the fastest connections in the the entire Oasis.
Oh, God.
But yes, they say that people who die when their characters get killed by the NPCs they usually respawn, but they go into this sort of void state, like this horrible like locked in syndrome kind of thing. And Artemis says, does anyone else find this shit completely terrifying? She said, raising her right hand, because I do. Shoto and I both raised our right hands in solidarity. And I just like flashing back to her, like spinning around in her, you know, pretty in pink outfit and saying, applause, please, from 90 minutes ago.
This was after also, so going postal is a thing. And she mutters, or Artemis muttered, Mother Pus Bucket.
Ugh.
Which I think is, besides being repulsive, is from a movie, I think.
It's
so I didn't look up what it was, but really?
Well, I'll look. Why not? It appears to be from Ghostbusters. It sounds like one of those, had it up here with this monkey riding snakes on this Mr. Falcon plane type of thing.
Yes.
TV edit.
Right.
But so they say that they describe it thusly that things were beginning to spiral out of control, which is what you described earlier as, you know, minutes away from the mass death. But that's the equivalent of, you know, Hitler, you know, loading the gun in his bunker, being like, things are really spiraling out of control for me now.
Yes. But they consider, Faisal considers, you know, we just put out a, you know, we just lie and say everything's fine and all of that again, right?
Uh-huh.
And so that But then they just override him and say, no, we have to do something about it. I'm just trying to get the plot in my head here.
Yeah, Faisal just suggests that. But Faisal is sort of an NPC in itself. He just sort of like, you know, does what he's needed to, and then he's quiet as everyone else has conversations around him.
Okay.
But they decide that the high score that Og got in the Sega Ninja Princess game turned out to be a clue. And then it indicates the address of a house he used to live at, which someone describes as hiding Og there would be a pretty clever move, actually. It's definitely the last place I would have ever thought to look for him. So, you know, to use that character's logic, you know, the last place they would ever think is one of the houses he used to live in.
Yes.
A place he has an incredibly strong connection to, not like, you know, Shakey's Pizza in Dubuque or whatever.
Right.
Like any given Roy Rogers off of I-95.
That would be the last place.
Yes, right.
But one of the things that they're... This is what I was trying to get to earlier. Apologies. So they can't have this happening because they ask, what do you think will happen when criminals all over the world figure out that they're surrounded by sitting ducks? People who can no longer log out of the oasis to protect themselves. Isn't this already happening? Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You log yourself into something and you are already a sitting duck for criminals. They've already made this point.
Yes, because...
And so that's why the rich people can have spider coffins.
Yeah. They say that 10% of people have spider coffins. The others are... yeah, I guess vulnerable to the organ thieves that roam around.
So the criminals are just being polite, but once they hear that they're really, really sitting ducks, then they'll become criminals again? And that's
yeah, it's
the
like
biggest
people waiting around for
have?
The purge night or whatever. They're just sort of you know, agreement among rogues or something.
I guess
you mentioned maybe
so. Okay.
They have like cameras, like you have a webcam so you can see if there's a guy in a black stocking cap and a black and white striped shirt breaking into your house to take your kidney or something.
Okay. All right. So it's airtight then, right? And I'm
picking
nits here. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Like every other thing that's been introduced in this book, every other concept, it's tied up all the loose ends.
Yeah. Okay.
But what they decide to do is probably much to Artemis's jealous heart's dismay, is they decide to call up Lohengrin and the Low Five.
Mm-hmm.
I do not remember the other names of them. They were all introduced and given a, you know, one sentence description so that the artists can start working on them, I guess, for the film adaptation. But I don't remember what any of them else were called. But
Rizzo, Wukong, Lilith, and Castiger are their names.
Right. But they all show up, and it says when they arrive there, they were all staring around wide-eyed, taking in their surroundings. But when they saw me, H. Shoto, and Artemis, their eyes grew even wider. So it just, it's got that, it's going to burst at some point in time if they just keep taking in things that they're not used to and are unexpected. It's not going to be healthy. They're going to be like that woman who got, you know, endorsements for a couple months back in the early aughts that could make her eyes do that, sort of bulge out of her skull.
Mm-hmm. But she had like thyroid condition, right? This is not something you want.
No,
maybe they're part owl, because isn't it true that like owls' eyes, you're only seeing like a hundredth of them, like they take up most of their head or something? So maybe they just have endless eye back there.
But then it says, and the book ends with, I mean, the chapter ends with this sort of dramatic sentence. And that was how the High Five met the Low Five for the very first time under extremely dire circumstances. Yep.
But before that, they bowed to them.
Oh, right. Yes.
What is this bowing crap? I don't get that.
It's these young Gunters who are now all billionaires, who just are sort of, you know, in awe of these dipshits that they've chosen to embrace as their heroes and aspirational gods.
It just doesn't seem like normal human behavior for a 20-year-old to bow to a 21-year-old.
Right,
yeah. Just seems a little odd.
Hey, they're rolling real, man. That's
right.
How the Low Five go.
That's right.
Well, that's it for chapter 19, I think. Do you want to do some fanfic before we keep moving?
And now I bet they bitching cause my flow switching, trying to tell me what to write upon some fan fiction. Can't they just be happy? I no longer have to face eviction. That I'm living on my life, I'm living on my inner vision right now.
Cruising on my last episode success. Let's see how we do here.
We're raising the overall rate, I think, in this one. This is like our Ted Williams batting 406 season. It's the abundance of fan fiction, but also, I don't know, I guess we're rising to the occasion.
Yeah. All right.
There's only, I think, two more RP2 episodes left, so there's only one more chance to get them in. But let's see if today's five entries are any trickier. As always, we have five pieces of writing, and they're all either from later in the book, written by Ernest Cline, hopefully future Pulitzer winner, and then some of them are written by our listeners. And you're going to try to guess which are which. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. Number one. That's when I saw two other figures, an olive-skinned man with bright blue hair wearing a brown tunic, and a figure wearing a red doublet with matching wide-brim cap, topped with a big white feather, piles of silver hair flowing from beneath. Our avatars have changed, said the silver-haired figure in Samantha's voice. I hope you see what's going on here, the blue-haired man said, sounding like Shoto. We're in the original Final Fantasy. You mean the 1987 classic that launched Squaresoft, later Square Enix, into the halls of fame as RPG masters, I replied. The very same, Shoto said. We're the Light Warriors. I'm a thief. Samantha is a red mage. You're a fighter, and H is a black mage. I can't wait to roast me some imps, H said with excitement.
Well, I don't know that game, obviously.
Obviously.
If it's real, the what did you
you're saying you've never heard of Final Fantasy?
No, I don't know anything about it.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Right. I've heard about it.
You could probably picture these 8-bit characters. I bet you've seen someone use one as their avatar before.
I'm sure I have. Wasn't it it was a movie though, or a series of movies? Yes.
They made some movies that were like, you know, early 2000s computer animation that were like as hyper realistic as you could get then.
Yeah.
Sort of like
I'm going to say that that's fanfic.
Okay. Number two. Artemis quirked her head at me and I felt my heart beat faster. What's the plan, Z? She asked. We're going to need Gunters. Lots of Gunters, I quipped, doing my best Neo imitation from The Matrix. But it came out more as Ted from Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. Keanu Reeves is a hard voice to match. If only Will Smith hadn't turned down the part of Neo to film Wild Wild West. I'd made Artemis snort laugh dozens of times, quoting his films in a perfect imitation. Even H had to admit it was spot on. Okay, Neo, Artemis said, still instantly understanding my joke. She laughed, but then the sound faded and she shook her head. It won't work. Anorak will see us coming from a mile away. It'll make D-Day look like baby's day out. That's why we aren't going to do it in the Oasis, I jabbed my finger at the camera feed. We're doing it out there. We're doing it in the Earl.
There's a lot of bait on that hook. I'm going to say that that's fanfic.
All right. Haven't heard much about the Earl in the past 200 pages.
No, what is the Earl again?
IRL.
Oh, the Earl. Yeah. The Earl. Got it.
Number three. You mentioned that you were taking guitar lessons, H said, to learn how to play a real guitar? Yeah, I said, still staring at the instrument in her hands. Why? Are you any good? I shrugged and clenched my hands into fists, because I was worried they might start shaking. Well, I'm no Wingy Malmsteen or anything, I said. I'm still learning. Well, school's out, Wingy, she said, holding the cloud guitar out to me. Duty calls.
Wow. I believe it. Is it Yngwie Malmsteen?
Yngwie, damn it. Well, whatever.
Well, I mean, it's pretty, it's, what is it? Y-I-N-G-W-I-E or something?
Like that. Y-N-G-W-I-E.
Yeah, I think it is Yngwie.
Yngwie. Sorry, Yngwie.
Well, that seems like it could be a fascination of his. I'm going to say that that's real.
All right. Yep, couldn't tell you a single lick. Here we go. All the quests here are trivia traps. You can't complete them unless you possess encyclopedic knowledge of Tolkien's entire legendarium. And I'm not just talking about the published version of the Silmarillion. You need to memorize details of a bunch of different conflicting, unpublished early drafts. And all 13 volumes of the History of Middle-earth. Sorry, I had research priorities. Like what? H asked, rolling her eyes, watching Monty Python and the Holy Grail for a 200th time. That was one of Halliday's favorite films, H, I shouted. Knowing it by heart helped us reach the egg, you may recall. And it also happens to be a comedic masterpiece. So, you told me you'd read every novel by every single one of Halliday's favorite authors, and Tolkien was on his list of favorites, man. I sighed. The Silmarillion isn't a novel, H. It's more like a campaign-setting sourcebook for the Middle-earth role-playing game. It's full of stories and poems about the creation of Middle-earth, its deities, history, and mythology, alphabets and pronunciation keys for made-up elven languages. I just never had time to finish it. H studied my face for a few seconds in silence. Then she pretended to sniff the air. I smell bullshit, Watts, she said, narrowing her eyes.
Oh, the I mentions are good.
Yeah, too.
I'm going to say that that's fanfic because I really, really hope that that's not true. That someone would be expected to memorize all the copies of the Silmarillion, even the unpublished ones.
Silmarillion discourse.
Yeah, all right.
All right, and we go to number 5. I approached my front door, and for the first time in a long time, I didn't want to face the emptiness that had defined the past few years. I was so caught up in my collection of classic cars and new systems and O&I coffins that I lost sight of the truth. Gaming is a communal activity. It's meant to be shared and enjoyed with others. Suddenly, the echoes that reverberated through the chambers of my home seemed a lot louder and colder. Before I turned the key in my lock, I made an oath. My home would no longer be a lifeless sarcophagus like Dracula's castle. It would become the greatest arcade to ever exist on the face of this Earth or any other planet, open for anyone and everyone to experience. Except, I walked in to find my foyer transformed into the architect's room from The Matrix Reloaded, with all of the TV screens showing my many adventures, even the stuff I swore I kept private. Sitting in the architect's chair, of course, was Anorak.
Oh, I don't know.
That's so terrible. What is your...
Well, I feel like it's something that he might try to do, so it's a clever bit of writing. I don't know. I'll say it's real.
Okay. All right. Well, if we're talking, you know, that before this it was only a coin flip, you still managed to increase your percentage, I think, here.
Okay.
You got 3 out of 5.
3 out of 5. Damn.
We're going through them one by one. Number one was the, they morphed into Final Fantasy avatars. That was, you said fanfic. That was fanfic written by Ted.
Okay.
Number two, that was him imitating Neo, but sounding like more like Ted. You said fanfic. That was fanfic written by Ezra. You had a lot of Keanu Reeves in this one. Number three was Yngwie Malmsteen. You thought that might be real. That is real. Written by Ernest Klein.
Nice.
Best-selling author. And then number four, the Tolkien Silmarillion. You said fanfic. That is real.
What?
I think that all the stuff about Og's thing, all the Tolkien stuff, I think that's where it all comes to a head.
Oh, and then, man.
Then number five, you thought the architect might show up. That was... You said real. That was Harris's fanfic.
Okay.
I left out some stuff. He said, Anorak, you son of a bitch, we destroyed you. And he said, please call me the Archerect. So 60%. Not bad.
I had higher hopes.
Hold your head up, like the band Argent sang. That was probably an 80s song, if not...
That 70s. Probably just squeaked into the 80s. All right. Chapter 20?
Yeah. Patreon plug first. A lot of those people were Patreon supporters who submitted those, so check out patreon.com/372pages. It's where all the good stuff goes down. We're doing a meme contest now, where I suggested the prize would be one of your books, Death Rat, signed by me. And I'll give one of my books, Pole Vault Championship of the Entire Universe, signed by you. They'll be guaranteed to be one of a kind.
Crisscross from that classic 80s movie that Hitchcock made in the 60s.
Yeah, what is it? Chapter. Okay. Oh, good. Phew. I was going to just pretend like I knew it and had seen it.
Okay. All right.
Chapter 20. So I did this. There's the time check. I just went to the end of the chapter and looked. So it's probably about a half an hour more. But by the end of this chapter, there's 2 hours and 28 minutes left before I hit his limit. H and Shoto each have 10 minutes less than me. And Faisal's about to hit the 2 hour mark. So that's what we're working with here as to keep in mind as all this dumb stuff happens, as all the petty arguments and fangirling and et cetera.
What does it all, I forget, does it all happen at once? Like Anorak just, you know, pulls the plug or? No, because everyone logged on at a different time.
Yeah, that's why I'd say that H and Shoto are about 10 minutes ahead and Faisal is really sweating it because he's a half hour ahead than all these people. And no indication, when the first people were logged in.
Right.
Even though clearly, so in Australia.
Other time zones and everything. Yeah.
Okay. It must be dropping dead by the thousand at this point in time.
Right.
All right.
What's your first note?
So it shows up. Lohengrin is talking about. He's talking about her. I think this is how the chapter started. It says Lohengrin's avatar was still in her female form, but now she was dressed in some sort of futuristic battle armor. The rest of her clan was similarly attired and also heavily armed. Once I finished making introductions and once Lohengrin and her friends finished freaking out, Lo told me what she'd been up to. So this is this is just where I thought that, like, it just might slightly distract from, you meeting your hero and bowing and fangirling and freaking out and squeeing if you had been told you were minutes from death.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I also feel like she has already been on a quest with him and he gave her $1 billion. I feel like the time for going is over. They've had a solid business agreement already completed.
Yeah, exactly. It's a she's had a taste of his life. She's already probably bought, multiple islands. She's lived the good life. She can buy and sell people. So dial it back a bit.
Yes.
But I thought about this, like how much it would actually sort of impact, what should be a big moment, like meeting a hero. And it turns out that there are people who speculated that as well out on the D-dub.
Oh, really?
That's what I call it now.
You've cruised it enough now that I feel like you can get familiar with it, sure.
Yeah, I've rerouted myself through multiple international proxies. My lag takes a bit of a hit as I do that, but it is the best way to browse the dark web because it's not all, imaginings of what characters in Dwight David Thrash books would do. There's also some gross stuff out there.
Just to be safe, I would also just run all of your searches through Shoto's translator and then back into English. I think that does it just an extra layer of security for you.
It gives me some plausible deniability, I think.
Sure. Okay.
But yeah, so there are people out there. A lot of our podcast listeners, they reply to us on Twitter or Facebook, and the most dedicated ones, of course, are on Patreon. They comment, they participate in the Discord chat. But there's even some out there on the dark web who view these books through the 372 lens. And so they released this weird sort of speculative fiction about me.
Oh, wow. Hey, yeah. Congratulations. You made
it. Well, it's off-putting, I think, to be honest. I'd like to discourage it in the future because, I don't know, I'm just relatively a private guy. I don't need people, thinking about this. But they evidently did some digging. They discovered that I was a big Cal Ripken Jr. fan growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I collected his individual baseball cards. I went as his baseball card for third grade Halloween. Like, my mom did one of those things where you cut a hole in the face. I think it was his 1988 Don Russ All-Star card. Anyway.
Okay.
But so they thought, like, what if I met my childhood hero? And they sort of did a reenactment of it on the dark web.
Oh, wow. Well, that's, I can see where that would get a little... just a little too close to home, but let's give it a listen. Hey, thanks for coming to Orioles Fan Fest. Next.
Hello, Mr. Ripken.
Yeah, step right up, pal. What's your name? What's the matter? Mickey Tettleton got your tongue?
Sorry. Just that I can't believe I'm meeting Cal Ripken Jr., the Iron Man himself. My name's Connor, and Mr. Ripken, sir, I...
No, it's just Cal.
Mr. Cal, sir, you were just my childhood hero. I
get that a lot. Grew up in Baltimore, did you?
Well, outside D.C., but it was before the Nats were in town, so...
Oh, Connor, was it? I should let you know, we've got about 40 minutes to live.
What's that?
We're all going to die in 40 minutes. Nukes are flying in from Russia or Australia, I don't know. I think we're going to nuke them, too. It's kind of a... You know that Sidney Lumet movie, Failsafe?
Yeah?
You do? Must have been referenced on The Simpsons or something.
Well, they made us watch it in eighth grade. Why is that important?
You just didn't strike me as the type of guy who would watch black and white Sidney Lumet movies from the early 60s.
Well, dude, that's not important!
Hey, a lot of people freak out when they meet their childhood hero.
Well, that is not why I'm freaking out.
All right, you got any cards for me to sign?
I can't believe this is happening. There was just so much more I wanted to do.
Last guy asked me to sign a copy of Cal Ripken Jr. Baseball for Super Nintendo. Forgot they even made that game.
Who should I call first? Lauren? Or my parents? Oh my God, all the circuits are busy. I can't get through.
Yeah, I got through to Eddie Murray earlier. He's stoic about the whole thing. But I'll tell you a time it wasn't stoic. Celebrating the clubhouse after we won the 1983 World Series.
I just wet my pants.
Happens all the time. I'm used to it.
Well, it's not because of you.
Hey, you don't have to play it cool. Can't imagine you met many Hall of Famers.
I think I'm having a panic attack.
2,131.
I don't care about how many games it took to break Lou Gehrig's consecutive game streak.
What's that? Gehrig? No, that's how many more seconds we have before the bombs annihilate the Eastern Seaboard. Hey, at least they're probably taking Jeffrey Mayer too, huh?
Find a happy place. Find a happy place. Find a happy place.
This is exactly how it went the first time I met Brooks Robinson.
I sincerely doubt that.
You just put people up on a pedestal, but hey, we're people just like you.
Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He has trampled down the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored.
Speaking of grapes, you know who owns a vineyard? Eddie Murray.
Ah!
You're handling this better than the last guy. He was so nervous he told me to say hello to Brady Sanderson.
I'm going to pass out.
Connor, was it?
Yeah, Cal?
I just noticed you didn't verify this info about the imminent nuclear attack, like, at all.
Huh?
You just took my word for it, that we were all going to die in under an hour. You didn't even ask the guy behind you in line or anything.
Did you...
I made it up, yes.
Now, why would you do that?
This is boring shit. I gotta spice it up. You know how many people come through here and ask me if Joe Ursulak was a nice guy?
Do a lot of people ask that?
Shockingly high.
Is he?
Joe Ursulak is a prince among men.
Wow. Oh, that's great to hear, Cal. You know, I think childhood me just squeed a little.
Got anything for me to sign?
Yeah, right here, your Don Russ rookie card.
Oh, Don Russ.
So did Chan Ho Park groove that All-Star Game pitch to you or what?
The funny thing about that is...
There you go. That's what it would have sounded like if I met Cal Ripken and he pranked me into thinking that that nuclear annihilation was imminent.
Do you feel it was accurate? How would you rate the reenactors out there?
To be honest, we always joke about how many words we've said and how they could pretty much assemble any deep fake from the amount of vocabulary we've fed into the internet. The guy pretty much, I think he was 98% there with my inflection. I think probably just didn't mispronounce as many things as I would have in real life.
Sure. Now, as a fan of a baseball player, have you read all of his favorite authors? All of Cal Ripken Jr.'s favorite authors?
Yeah, you and know, then... I when I got to the 11th book in the Silmarillion pre-trilogy, I sort of wondered like where he fit all the time for this in, because he did, you know, maintain 2 decades of high level athleticism.
Yeah.
So he didn't strike me as like a Sean Doolittle type who was, you know, reading on the plane. I think Cal was gambling or like challenging guys to push up contests, but
because if you had to know, like, what if you had to know everything about George Brett? Then that would be a little rough, because he likes to talk. Isn't he the one who talks famously about his bathroom habits?
He is. He makes it a point to crap his pants once a year.
Okay,
and see, that sounds like something we're making up, like on the sense of a ABDL kind of guy, but it's out there.
It's out there. All right, chapter 20.
Yeah. So they reveal to the Low Five has sort of like ran this quest. They went around to all of the houses where Wade and Lohengrin had already been. They went to all 255 of those houses, and they've discovered that in one of them, Og has been leaving them some clues. And mm-hmm. he's doing this, you know, the way a kidnapping victim might, you know, leave clues, like the way the guy in Stephen King's Misery moved the penguin or something.
Yes.
Like he left them a copy of an obscure John Belushi DVD. And I was just like, if this is what he's doing to try to let people know, you know, where he is and to save him, that any detective would be like, no, I think he has Stockholm syndrome. He wants to remain kidnapped. He is he's not doing this in a good job, in a way that anyone would actually notice.
This is a rather half-assed, and that shows his motivation. Like, he does not really care. Neighbors.
Right. Never heard of it.
Oh, it's, I think famously, because he was so white hot at the time, that it got a big rollout and everyone just went, huh? I think it was quickly forgotten.
Okay.
I'm sure there are defenders out there. I mean, Shota could probably tell us there's probably fans of it out there on the internet somewhere. but I don't know what it's about.
Was it Neighbors, the like Tommy Wiseau's immediate follow-up to The Room?
Yes. Yes,
I indeed. Never watched it. I think I was out of town or something, and you know, we got the advanced copy of it or something, and I came in and I was like, and you and Sean were like, just no, lightning does not strike twice. And I was like, how bad could it be? And you're like, I'm not even going to watch it again if you watch it. Like,
it's technically unwatchable. Yeah.
But yeah, the Low Five seemed to take the news that they were being held hostage extremely well. They did a lot of cursing and shouting, but no one had a full-on meltdown.
Wow.
I don't know. I don't know what to make of these idiots.
I have a lot of dumb sentences from this chapter, but not a lot of notes for it, I'm afraid.
All right. I issued it early on, but I had an editor's challenge.
Oh, okay.
This was where we take a sentence or a couple sentences and ask what a theoretical editor would do, since obviously one didn't work on this book. It's this passage. It says, I think it was a member of the Low Five talking. We found an old Dungeons & Dragons campaign notebook, too, she said. But it wasn't in Og's handwriting. Did it belong to Halliday, so Choto asked? When he still lived at home, Halliday had to keep all of his D&D stuff over at Og's house because his parents thought D&D was satanic and forbid him from playing it. Definitely not, Low replied. It's Kira's old campaign notebook. So I summoned my greater Lauren, my greater Ezra Pound, and I edited that passage. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We found Kira's old Dungeons and Dragons campaign notebook. You don't need to give Shoto any time to ask a bunch of unrelated questions. You can include that information in your initial announcement, since, as it's been made clear, the clock is ticking. You have under 2 hours to go.
Yeah, that is an unforced error that appears in a lot of our movies as well, where a character will just waste a few sentences, you know, speculating about something when someone's in the middle of explaining it. Just like, what? Why don't you just let me get to the end of my sentence? That we don't need to burn this film on this particular thing that is going to turn out to be no. The answer is no.
Right. but it's a there. She Lo continues to lack focus. She explains 4 paragraphs the Kira's adventure, what her D&D campaign was about. People ask her questions, whether, you know, Kira's character Lucosia appears in it, and we get detailed descriptions of Lucosia's deal. And it's all to reveal another idiotic anagram puzzle where the evil character in his campaign was Hagmar, which is an anagram of Graham, her abusive stepfather.
Yes, it went Digital Fortress on us yet again there.
I guess that's the, if you're a bad author, that's the pinnacle of puzzle solving for you is basic anagrams.
Yeah, it doesn't strike me as what's the genius organization?
Mensa.
They're really into puzzles. Yeah, Mensa's really a lot of puzzles, right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Just scrambling a word. Word scrambles don't seem that puzzling to me.
Right. That's what you you busy yourself with as you're sipping an airport beer on one of those Mega Touch games. It's not exactly Einstein stuff.
But we do get at this high level, and as the clock is ticking down, we get a long explanation of the Dork Slayer.
Oh my God.
Which is the sword. Og forged a special sword to kill Anorak and called it the Dork Slayer.
Mm-hmm.
So, serious stuff, guys. Seriously.
Yeah, deeply unfortunate. but that, you know, so you introduce those things like Dork Slayer that are just, you know, some of the you know, cringy internet-y anti-squee. But that's on the heels of, like, you know, the more turn to the camera stuff about sexism and stuff. We get a two you know, back-to-back paragraphs. It says, "I remembered that in his autobiography, Og had complained about Halliday's sexist behavior toward Kira more than once." Next paragraph. "I remembered having my first real argument with Artemis once about that very subject." She'd started it by stating that Kira Morrow deserved to be listed along Og and Halliday as one of the true co-creators of the Oasis. She'd made comparisons to Rosalind Franklin, a woman who deserved to be credited alongside Watson and Crick as one of the discoverers of the double helix structure of DNA, or Katherine Johnson, whose calculations helped us reach the moon. Turns to the camera. Or countless other women who had been brushed aside or blatantly ignored. So it's the rarely seen, turned to the camera, but also, and the resting, all these people that he's trying to defend the honor of.
Oh, he's not good. He's not good. but he's, and I mean, Halliday, he's always been a monster of a person, right? There's no, it's not like it's been suddenly revealed in book two that he's terrible.
Yeah. No.
Because he's always been, and our hero has always known he's been terrible. He just
our
rushes
hero bit
to
his
defend
tongue.
Him.
Yeah, bit his tongue to try to not call him a sociopath last episode.
Yeah. But as his strong moral stance, he doesn't change the policy that Kira and Og had put in place about right. hiring one woman for every man. So it was like, look, he's not that bad. He didn't change the policy.
Right, yes. He didn't actively work to undo things.
Yes.
But he also says, all these years later, I could finally see she'd been right all along. I'd just been too much of a slavish Halliday fanboy to believe anything bad about him. How times had changed. Like, this minute they just changed?
Yeah, when did they change? I was struck by that too. Like, what?
He was in Happy Time Pizza trying to bite his tongue as they called him a terrible guy. So I guess it is
right
in this exact moment with an hour and 47 minutes left before everyone dies.
Yeah. I picked up this. This, I think, is the moment when I said we have to count them. Geez Louise, Shoto said, rolling his eyes. He turned to me. We're going to be looking for Horcruxes next.
Yeah.
Shoto, just shut the rig down. Get out of here.
Is that a colloquialism that translates to Japanese?
Geez Louise, yeah, that's a good question. I wonder what it is in Japanese.
I think that was one of the almost back-to-back eye rolls. I think someone rolls their eyes maybe a paragraph later.
Oh, boy.
But yeah, the idea that they're going to be looking for Horcruxes, I believe there were seven of those, so it was clearly meant to echo that from the very beginning, and that does still fill me with fear that we might be mating NPC Ernest Cline at some point in time.
Yeah, It's going to happen. God, I hope it does.
Meta.
Yeah, don't you think someone would have found that and it would have been in real or fanfic?
Yeah, I suppose. I don't think anyone would have been able to resist that tidbit. You're right. All right, faith restored.
Yes.
While we're talking cliches, I think this is a good one. I think Lohengrin this is describing. She raised her eyes to meet mine, and I could see the steely resolve in them. And I admire that. If you're going to have resolve, make it steely. Brought to you by Steely Resolve. There's no, like, steadfast resolve. Get that trash out of here. Like, you know, just get the brand name Resolve. Steely.
Yes. Oh, he's got his cliches and he sticks to them. Why does she turn into James Spader?
I don't remember. I couldn't place it. And
I don't think it is explained. I think it's just some sort of joke that I don't get or something.
She hit the wrong button as she was like trying to alt tab to another or to something else.
I guess so.
Did that trigger applause from characters? Because they already applauded her for doing something.
Oh, yeah, I have that written down. She, Artemis and H both nodded and began to applaud. Shoto and I joined in. Lo took a small bow, then she motioned to her friends.
So, yeah, everyone's just bowing and applauding each other. It's like a weird, you know, cult or something where they have these nonverbal communications they're doing at various times.
Yeah, it's the... you know, wear the certain color ribbon cult, you know, or something. Like, I don't know. But that's all I have for chapter 20.
What do you think people would do if, like, the next time we got together in Nashville, if just we just started, you know, applauding each other for various, like, when was the last time you did that to anybody just as a, even like playing a game or something? You're playing charades and your teammate gets something, you applaud them. People would just, like, ask you to leave the party.
I can't imagine under what circumstances.
I want to end this chapter. My last thing was a character ID challenge. I want you to tell me who this is.
Okay.
The second we'd finished, Artemis jumped to her feet and prepared to leave. Tell Miles and his team I'm logging out right now. Who's Miles?
I have no idea.
Okay. I didn't know. And as I was talking, taking notes, I think I realized and I was correct. He is the head of the security team who bears a distinct resemblance to young Arnold Schwarzenegger, the older post-governator Arnold.
Oh, yes.
He was mentioned once and 150 pages ago and expected to remember that strong character.
And that is especially galling in a book where there's just name drops everywhere, where it takes you a second to go, oh, that's just a name drop. I don't need to know who that person is. So then to do it with a character where you're supposed to remember who was, you know, 500 pages ago, it's just insane.
Yeah, because, you know, tell Miles and his team I'm logging out. It just as easily could be a line from Short Circuit 2 or something. Like the fact that they just toss those in without us. I guess usually people chuckle in recognition when they do those, but that was the context clue that it wasn't a quote.
Well, here we go. We're going to Minneapolis.
Here we are. Yep, heavy heart. We're coming home to the Prince planet. Just give me a rundown of your Prince, your relationship. What's your Prince deal?
My own Prince deal. I mean, I've seen him a number of times. Yeah, at bars and things.
Wow.
Where he'd come in and just play. I once was going up the stairs at, it wasn't even First Avenue, it was a William's Peanut Bar, and I think I ran into him and almost knocked him down.
Wow.
And then his big, he had a big bodyguard who was very, very familiar. Sort of a famous guy in his own right, sort of picked him back up, and they rushed past me without saying anything.
Wow, that's cool.
There was that. We recorded part of our the Mystery Science in a studio that was run by his manager of Paisley Park. So he had, so we had nothing but time and for him to tell Prince stories. So I got a lot of inside stuff by his manager. So that was, And that's about it. And, you know, going to see him at First Ave and all that stuff.
All right. Well, you know, so you're, you know, after H, you're probably the second most knowledge of Prince in all of recorded history.
Well, remember how I tried to get you again and again to watch Purple Rain?
But
you were sexually confused.
I did. I was so embarrassed and sexually confused. And then I was so embarrassed that I admitted that was why I didn't want to watch it.
Yes.
And then you applauded me for saying that.
Yes.
And I bowed.
So they
go to Prince Planet. I forget what it was
they
called.
They go to Paisley Park, mm-hmm. and they see the thousands of... This is my first note on it. It's phrases like, thank you, Prince, and we love you, Prince, and we miss you, Prince, were repeated over and over again in different colors and different handwritings. Were they phrases like that, or were they those phrases? Because you could just give us the actual phrases. You don't have to tell us. So similar to this phrase. Like, yeah, I understand.
Yeah, you're in the habit of saying, and many more. You could have said, I saw three phrases. We miss you, Prince. We love you, Prince. And many more.
Yes.
Well, I love that part because he says, he's admitted that he doesn't know much about Prince. But he says, as I scanned Prince's discography, I noticed he had released both an album and a movie titled Graffiti Bridge. So in an effort to appear like I actually knew something about this place, I turned to Shoto and said, this is the famous Graffiti Bridge that inspired the album and film of the same name. And I just, my only note was, what a dipshit. It just, you know, he does this embarrassing thing that is in, you know, unable to differentiate from any other behavior he's demonstrated throughout these entire two books.
I wrote that note for a slightly different reason. Again, as I scanned Prince's discography, I noticed that he had released both an album. You notice that because that's an actual thing. You know, I noticed that Abraham Lincoln was the 16th president. Right? It's just a weird way to say that. Like, yeah, I noticed. I just noticed this because it is a fact that is right in front of your eyes.
Yeah.
And you're currently reading it.
Yeah. What was the thing that Shoto kept doing? Shoto referred to the...
Yes.
Shoto said that. That's all we need to... That's all you need to tell us.
They just knock around. Yeah, they just kind of knock around all of these locations from movies and things.
Yeah, they go to, I think, to the entrance of Paisley Park, and that's where we get our first needle drop. It says, church-like organ music filled our ears. The song identification software running on my HUD identified it as the opening of a song called Let's Go Crazy. And this is just sort of where he's recused himself from knowing anything about Prince, even though, you know, the entire last point of the last book was he's obsessed with the 80s and everything in it. And so it just, this phrasing, it identified it as the opening of a song called Let's Go Crazy. And I said, like, it's like a self-professed 60s nut. I looked down at the jukebox, which indicated the song playing was Like a Rolling Stone by Bob Dylan. Or a Da Vinci scholar. I scanned the unfamiliar painting with my HUD, and after a split second, Max identified it as the Mona Lisa, or a birding nut. The unfamiliar gray and white bird in front of me was known as a seagull. It's like, you absolutely, you know, one of his most famous songs, impossible to imagine a scholar of the 80s, never having encountered it before.
I wonder what was he thinking for the reason for that? Just like, I probably shouldn't be an expert on everything, so he just like pick one?
Yeah.
It doesn't have any story-wise, it doesn't matter, because he's standing next to someone who knows every single thing about Prince, you know, in the world. So I don't understand why the gap story-wise.
Yeah, it's extremely confusing because he just like the Sega Ninja Princess game, he has someone standing next to him who can just walk him through it. So if you're worried about the you know, Mary Sue effect of him being too good at everything, that ship has sailed a long time ago.
Right.
But yeah, it's because it just, you know, he hand waved it away with, like, you know, watching Prince, you know, I felt an odd stirring in my loins, and so I had to leave the chat link.
Yeah. Here's one. I didn't know this was a thing. I thought she was going to hop on the bike and steal it, but instead she pulled a giant serrated Rambo knife out of her inventory and slashed the motorcycle's tires. Did you just call it? Is it just a Rambo knife? Is that like an actual, that's a term?
That's a good question.
Or is it a knife? What, you know, from the famous 80s, classic 80s film Rambo or First Blood or whatever? I just didn't know that it suddenly gets that. We'll have to check with a certain Australian
get someone to friend weigh of in. Ours
to yeah. see. Yeah.
Yeah.
Steve they, Miller, of course, is who I'm talking
about. Of course. we need clarification on whether it's a Rambo knife. Sorry, mate. Only weigh in on knifeness. Can't pass it anymore for you. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe it could just be that sort of thing that's like she folded her arms like Wonder Woman, that type of thing. Like just saying it's a Rambo knife is just like, I guess, means big knife.
Yep. Okay. Fair enough. And then he gets very specific. This is where, okay, most of the surface was covered by a surreal, shrunken down version of mid-80s Minneapolis, Minnesota. Mm-hmm. But it had streets and locations from L.A., Paris, and several other locations scattered throughout. The map that divided the city into different neighborhoods like Big City, Erotic City, Crystal City, Beat Town, and Uptown.
Okay.
So, I mean, Uptown is real. I don't understand what. What is Beat Town? Is that a song of his? Is Crystal City a song of his? Erotic City is.
My Prince knowledge is closer to Wade's than H's, I would say.
But I just don't understand why L.A. and Paris, if you're in mid-80s Minneapolis.
The Hollywood Bowl being in Shermer, Illinois, I guess, that sort of thing. But, you know, we also, it's the third thing he's called surreal in this chapter. He had a surreal spiral staircase, and then he has another surreal landscape and a surreal mid-80s Minneapolis. Like, it's the... It's such a lazy, bad way of describing any of this. Because for one, we know it's surreal because it's a computer simulation. But if you looked at like the persistence of memory, the Dolly painting, and you know, had to describe it to somebody who was not able to see it, you know, as an author, and all you said was it's surreal.
Yes.
And then they, when they finally got a look at it, they were like, "You son of a bitch! Like, there's a lot going on here." Like, ants are marching along a melting clock? Like, give me some details. Like, it's just, it's so stupid and lazy.
Do you, I think he's just using it in the same way that, I don't know, I don't think it's a thing anymore, but the word random, when that completely took over and lost all meaning.
It's so like, random.
My mom is being so random, you know. I don't think he knows that surreal, you know, it's a word that means something. I think he just means, like, you're just supposed to go, weird, man.
Yep.
It's really weird to look at.
Yeah. It's like the, you know, again, like describing your dream to someone. Well, you know what I mean. Like, it was my house, but it wasn't my house. Like,
yes.
Yeah. I know what you mean. And please stop describing your dream to me. No one enjoys this. So what H got tears in her eyes when she stabbed the thing with her Rambo knife. And so we're just entering more dangerous turf of these terrible characters having emotions. And I frankly, you know, I cannot even with that.
I forget what was the reason behind it. I'm sorry, I forgot to write that down.
You don't get it then, but later on it's revealed why she is so emotional and why she knows so much about Prince.
Oh, okay.
We do get it. But first we get Shoto again chiming in with you know, it's pretty obvious that Prince was plagiarizing those old Jordache jeans commercials when he wrote this song. He laughed and began to mix up the song and the jeans jingle using a set of holographic turntables that he produced from his inventory. "You've got the look," he sang. "You've got the look, the Jordache look." So if we play by your rules and Jordache, Shoto's son is, you know, being on life support and they brought in a priest. This is what he's doing. He's producing digital turntables and joking about Jordache jeans. And it is 90 minutes until the, you know, everything happens.
I have the exact thing there. I said, "You are going to die in less than 2 hours. Your child will never know her father." Right over that Jordache look. But here's, I noticed this was, he describes a very specific place that you and I have been to this place a few times. And I was remiss about not describing it this way as we were there. Okay. H was very specific about each turn she took, like she was entering the combination to a safe. She led us right onto South 5th Street, left onto 2nd Avenue South, right onto South 4th Street, left onto 3rd Avenue South, and then right onto South 3rd Street.
Good Lord.
He's actually putting this in a book. Anyway, if you come to town again for a Twins game, I'll take you that very route.
Okay, and where does that lead you to?
Well, it's right next to the Twins Stadium, which obviously wasn't there in the... Yeah. So that's where we'd be. But as we go through the, you know, walk through the seating area, I'll try to recreate her movements through that area.
It reminds me of actually, I mean, it's terrible in a book, but it reminds me of a Hold Steady song, Southtown Girls. It's take Lindale out to the horizon, take Nicolette out to the ocean, take Penn Avenue out to the 494, meet me right in front of the fabric store. So I might have sobbed like H if Ernest Cline had revealed himself to be a Hold Steady devotee. That might have hit too close to home.
Did he say the 494?
Maybe I added that in. Is that
okay?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the Google results for Southtown Girls lyrics. Take Penn Avenue out to the 494. I think that's what Craig Finn says.
Oh wow! He must have. He was writing it from California, and he just added the.
Oh man.
There's no such thing as the 494. That has never been uttered by a Minnesota.
Oh, then he says, take Lindale back to the south side. Take Nicolette up to the Vietnamese. Take Penn Avenue back to the north side. Take Lowry east to the quarry.
Hmm. Okay.
Are you there in your mind? That's a mental picture.
Lowry to the quarry. I can't picture that. All right. Anyway.
It's a better song than this book is. Than, you know, it sounds better with the music than this book does.
I trust that it was.
H's dying. I mean, Shoto's dying son. There was a nightclub with a vulva-shaped entrance. The pulsing pink neon sign above it read "A Love Bazaar." Shoto took a few steps toward it as if hypnotized, but H pulled him back, shaking her head. "You're a married man, Shoto," H said. So it's like a John Ritter movie or something, or like, you know, a Weekend at Bernie's, like, you know, the guy starts like marching towards something. Not now, man. Like, you know, sorry.
Here's another one. When we emerged from the other end of the alley, H quickened her pace, and Shoto and I did the same to keep up with her as she continued to bob, sidestep, and weave through all the crowd and surreal landscape around us. Nice. Which appeared to be a living mashup of all of Prince's different album covers and music videos.
Oh, wow.
Appeared to or was? You're in charge of this. What was it?
I love that one. It's just, you know, it's the same thing as a wide variety of 80s dance moves.
Yes.
You know, you can describe them. People, if you were a Prince fan, you would love that. If there was some, like... detail like from the Sign of the Times album cover, like, you know, you could describe whatever that was. And then the type of bike from the Purple Rain one and all these other things, like that's a perfect opportunity to just do a dump of garbage like that. But all you're just doing, and if you've seen the album covers, it was like that.
Right. It's just a mashup of everything that you can remember about Prince. I'm not going to be bothered to describe it. You just remember it and have a good day.
Yeah. It was a bunch of good things that you like. All of them were there. we do then get... Shoto was going to walk into the strip club, but then Sheila E. walks by in a tight blue dress. She sauntered right up to Erotic City and beckons them. H looked tempted for a second. But then, I think maybe probably 45 words later, H starts getting choked up because she describes... why she knows so much about Prince. She says, the Prince records and videotapes I inherited from my dad when he moved out, they were the only things he left behind. Besides me, I guess. Growing up knowing he'd been such a huge Prince fan always made me wish he'd stuck around. I figured he probably would have been okay with my sexuality, or at least more choking, accepting of it than my mother. And Wade says, it makes total sense, H, I said after a moment. First, your mom rejects you, and then Prince... who was like a surrogate for your dad, he rejected you too. And so I was wondering, just like, you know, this is probably, she left when he was, I don't know, 12, like 13, 14?
Mm-hmm.
Which of these Prince songs was more like a surrogate for her dad? Was it Jack You Off from 1981's Controversy? Was it Let's Pretend We're Married with I mean, I don't know if we want to read the lyrics to these. Was it the lyrics to Sexy MF, which repeats, sexy mother shaking that ass, shaking that ass, shaking that ass?
Oh, yeah.
Which of those did H fall asleep to, thinking like, dad?
Oh, yeah. His, I mean, it was always there, but I think the early stuff was quite explicit.
Yeah, I just Googled top 10 dirtiest Prince songs, and that turned out. There was Darling Nikki, of course, where she's in the hotel lobby. And mm-hmm. I don't know how young people listen to this are.
Yeah, I don't know. Question for you here. When you were wearing an ONI headset, getting hit by lightning was no joke. Okay. It was almost as bad as getting tasered. So when you built the ONI, you made getting hit by lightning less bad than getting tasered?
Yeah. That's
that had to be engineered into the feature?
Yeah. And has being getting tasered been a big part of this book? Like, is that something we're able to pinpoint? Like, oh, right, the many times you've been tasered.
I think he's trying to say it in the Earl getting tasered, but it does not appear that way. It sounds like the ONI, it's almost as bad. but also, why wouldn't you disable that feature and go to your little gear settings icon on your ONI and go, hey, how about I just disable the thing where I get struck by lightning?
Yep, it was like
and my own suit that tasers me.
Yeah, he said you could feel every gunshot. We're like, you'd want that? It seems, again, not good.
Yes.
And also, Shoto was blasted by the lightning because he insulted his royal badness, as H keeps calling him. H also could have just said, as they're materializing, oh, by the way, don't insult Prince or you get struck by lightning. It's just going to slow you down if one of your guys is... having to, smolder and have their eyes blink a lot like Wile E. Coyote after you get struck by lightning.
Yes. But that's the extent of it for me.
Yeah.
I'm done.
It says there's an hour and 45 minutes remaining before everyone dies. They duck into a five and dime store as a needle drop of Raspberry Beret starts playing. And, I mean, I guess we glossed over it, but the whole point of this is that they're... the clue they've interpreted that they're going to have to fight the seven different stages of Prince. So throughout his career, I guess he changed looks and vibes and names. So they're going to just, that's who they're going to have to defeat as the final bosses of all this.
Maybe at some point I'll tell the story of a friend of ours who was proselytized by Prince in his home.
Oh, wow.
As a JW.
Wow. He would just go door to door. I mean, that would be a, you could describe that to someone later as a surreal experience. You open your door and Prince is there.
The funny thing was, this guy was a very, he was a very studious fella. I think he was studying to be like a Presbyterian minister or something. And just constantly reading books, And after it happened, he asked people, he said, and so they came in and they sat down and the first guy introduced himself. He said, I'm ready to have, I'll talk about this stuff. And the first guy introduced himself and then turned to Prince and said, and I suppose you know who this is. And the guy goes, no, nice to meet you. What's your name?
Oh man.
And he's like, oh, it's Prince. So he's like, oh, okay. And then, so he started asking people, am I supposed to know who this Prince guy is?
Wow.
He did not grow up in Minneapolis, so that's why he didn't know.
That would be a fun, kind of makes me want to become a Jehovah's Witness just so I can go and do that with whoever I'm walking around with. And I suppose you know who this is? And it's just Tim from accounting. Yes.
Oh, anyway, whew. That's such a lot of stupidity. Yeah.
It was. It is. It just, we're sort of mainlining it with these episodes. It's like doing that virtual heroin mixed with other stuff.
Which is totally not addicting and does not hurt you in any way.
Right. Yes. 100%. Well, it feels as much like getting tasered would. Let's do some dumb sentences.
A sentence begins with a capital letter. A capital letter is a letter that's big. A capital letter is not a small letter. A capital letter is big, big, big. A sentence ends with a period. or an exclamation or a question mark.
All right, dumb sentences. I feel like there's going to be probably a lot of crossover on these.
Yeah,
there are some real dumb sentences.
All right, let's start with the ones from our listeners. This is one from Jonathan from Arkansas, and he said, I felt like we were walking into the hippest night spot on the ninth level of Dante's Inferno. And he submitted two sentences, but I'm going to allow it. All the lighting was reddish in hue. There were flames everywhere you looked. Lit candles on every table, torches mounted on the walls and balcony railings, and dozens of burning fireplaces upstairs and down. And he just said, Furnace Klein had actually read the Inferno. You would know that the ninth circle, not level, of hell is actually cold and icy because it is located in a frozen lake called Cocytus. He said, this one struck me so much because even if you did the most cursory Wikipedia glance, you would see this fact when you juxtapose this with excruciating level of detail he utilizes when talking about the video game he plays early in this book. It shows he clearly didn't do any research at all. By trying to add a highbrow literary reference, he inadvertently made everything even dumber.
Oh, come on. You weren't roped in by, what, Salinger Fields or whatever?
Right, true. Taylor submitted, then she grinned and abruptly transformed into a young James Spader.
Okay, that's just in the middle of something. I swear that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, and he said it's fun to imagine this line appearing in any other book with no explanation. We got Brian, who submitted, I searched my memory, and a few seconds later, it produced the address, and I said it out loud.
Wow.
It's like a human reminding himself how to walk or breathe. Here's one from Ezra. This is all one sentence. Like an overly knowledgeable tour guide, H explained how each of the venues we saw here on the Afterworld was a replica of a real club or concert hall or stadium where Prince had once performed, and that you could walk into any one of them, sit down in an audience of period-appropriate NPCs, and watch a recreation of the gigs that Prince had once performed there, detailed immersive situations extrapolated from old photographs and archived video and audio recordings. Ugh. H explained that to them. That's
God. Oh, that is just awful.
This is from Amanda. She said, now everyone in the room was motionless, staring at Andy and Ducky with bourgeois contempt burning in their eyes. And my theory was that bourgeois was the word Ernest Klein got out on in the eighth grade spelling bee. And so he's determined to use it whenever he can.
Boy, the eyes are doing a lot of heavy lifting in this book.
Yeah. Oh, man. It's
burning with bourgeois contempt, rolling around like marbles.
widening, bulging, burning. Michael Esquire. There was a giant console television on one side of the room, positioned directly in front of an even more enormous blue couch. He said, why is there a console television? This was Wade's childhood retreat to the distant future. Was he already into 80s retro when he was a toddler? Second, couches are bigger than TVs, console or otherwise, so it's a pretty bad comparison. And he concluded a comparison. The baked potato was huge, and it sat on an even bigger dining room table. John submitted, I recognized both of them from their brief scene in The Breakfast Club when they drop Anthony Michael Hall's character Brian off at detention, and his mom says, well, mister, you better figure out a way to study, and then his little sister says, yeah. it's an email. Okay, that's all of the dumb sentences. Do we have that didn't get burned already? Do you have any more?
I do. Most of those I had noted, but I got plenty. But this is the one I'm going to go with, and bear with me. Here you go. When Kira and Og founded Halcedonia Interactive and created this planet, they'd cooked up the bee-free treehouses as a way to give kids around the world a free, happy virtual home inside the oasis that they could always escape to and find themselves surrounded by an endless assortment of furry friends and anthropomorphic animal teachers who were always overjoyed to see them and who just wanted to teach them how to read, write, spell, and do arithmetic, all while staying physically fit and being kind to others. Period.
Said the robot pimp disdainfully. It's just unreal when you, I mean, what does it sound like when the audiobook reads those?
I don't know.
He's going to need oxygen in the recording booth.
Who did the first one? Was it?
Will Wheaton does them both.
Will Wheaton.
Yeah.
We got to pull that up. How does Will Wheaton tackle that sentence?
Well, here's another one from mine was also from the planet Halcedonia. If I did, there was a good chance she would send me off on a mandatory math quest to rescue one of her royal relatives, usually her husband, the clueless King Itzelot, who was constantly being taken prisoner by the evil wizard Multiplicatar, who tossed him into the long division dungeons beneath Protractor Peak, located high in the Morstuff Mountains. Just, I guess it's, you know, it's supposed to be cute, but it's just, it's so revolting. I could not deal with it.
I have a bonus one.
Okay.
I resisted the urge to yell, "No shit, Sherlock." Thank you for resisting that urge.
Very good. Very good idea. I guess I just don't have the urge, but if I did, I would hopefully be able to resist that as well. Resisting yes. Stephanie Tanner level retorts to people. We do have a few emails to close this episode out.
We go to the party. We go to the game. We ain't going to the disco, ain't gonna cruise out, man. We're stealing people's mail, stealing people's mail, stealing people's mail.
All right, and here's Sting to play us out. No, the final letters to play us out.
I always like it when people send in their highbrow critiques of this. This is one from Joe. He says, "Over a century ago, Mark Twain wrote an essay excoriating James Fenimore Cooper's terrible writing. The entire essay is entertaining and very much in the 372 pages spirit, but one of the more memorable things Twain writes in it is, when a person has a poor ear for music, he will flat and sharp right along without knowing it. He keeps near the tune, but it is not the tune. When a person has a poor ear for words, the result is a literary flattening. It's a literary flatting and sharping. You perceive what he is intending to say, but you also perceive he does not say it." This is the perfect description of the feeling I get from Klein's writing. It needs whatever the writer's equivalent of autotune is. It still wouldn't be deathless prose for the ages, but at least it wouldn't be an assault on the reader's brain.
Yeah, that's very good. Yeah, that's true. You're always trying to force it into your own, you know, words, because it just clunks at every moment.
Right, yeah. It's sort of just... like the, you know, just below the uncanny valley type of thing for actual prose. This one is from G. Sean. He says, "Not exactly a hell of a rig, but how about those 40 vibration points?" And he links to an article. B Haptics has introduced a range of wireless haptic vests that will provide physical feedback from VR and gaming content. Prices start at $299. And the TacSuit H16 offers 16 different vibration points, while the TacSuit X40 $499 comes with 40 different vibration points.
Does it kick you in the nuts, though?
I think that's what the extra $200 gets you. Those additional 26 points. One of them has to be a microfiber crotch inlay. I mean, this one is from Static. Said, "Just wanted to drop a line and tell you how much I'm enjoying the podcast. I liked it so much that I'm on my third or fourth re-listen through all 92 episodes."
Good heavens.
Yeah.
Good on
you. Back to back? No telling. But he said he always likes listening so many times because I always catch some little tidbit I missed, like the plug for Connor's Audible original. "I really enjoyed listening it and even found what might be called a 372 pages Easter egg at some point during the sequence of events on Hawal. Cornelius calls everyone a bunch of jackals. Coincidence?"
Oh.
And I said, that must be just a deep-seated desire to call people jackals. So that's good. That's out there. This one is from Ezra. He said, "I noticed this and couldn't unnotice it because it's so lazy and inconsistent. Klein flip-flops between... my saying my inventory, her inventory, and my avatar's inventory or her avatar's inventory with zero reason. There is, of course, no reason to say my avatar's inventory since we all know that 99% of the book takes place in the Oasis. It's like he has to just say it to remind us it's an avatar, then a page later forgets and says my inventory. I hate it."
Editor, call for that editor again.
Right. This is from Josh. "Something I find hard to believe about the fictional Oasis is people collaborating to make highly detailed and complicated recreations and syntheses of most fictional works, even if the tools to do so makes things very easy. Only a few franchises, your Star Warses, might have enough effort put into them. But John Hughes? The John Hughes wiki at johnhughes.fandom.com has all of 22 pages. That community is not creating its own planet." And then the last email we got was from Martina. She said, "I'm obsessed with the idea of Steven Spielberg being unable to get the rights to Prince for his Ready Player 2 movie, so I'd like to present you with some concept art for something the studio can probably afford. Seven Evil Hall of Notes. And she sent that drawing, which I have already posted to the 372 Twitters and Facebooks. I think would probably improve things immensely.
Oh, that's it, right?
Yeah, that's it. Thanks to everybody who wrote in. But that's it for this week. I think we have two more of these left to go. We're going to read through chapter 26 for next time.
I will. I'll leave you with this tantalizing thought. I had forgotten this until this moment. That my band, my college band, did a parody of Raspberry Beret as one of our songs. And so you can try to guess what that would be called, and I will reveal it next time.
Okay, good. I'll come in with my own guess, and our listeners can write in.
Okay, sounds good.
All right. So yeah, read through chapter 26, and thanks to everyone on Patreon, patreon.com/372pages. This is Connor.
And Michael J., so long.